Before we start this episode of CFD's Podcast for Good, let's give a little shout out to our presenting sponsor, WSECU. WSECU has been a part of the community since 1957 and has been supporting the CFD in a big way since 2011. Thanks to them, we were able to bring you spectacular events and promotions like the Masquerade Ball, Golf for Veterans Tournament, and our incredible First Week to Give, which has been responsible for raising tens of thousands of dollars in donations to charities throughout our community. For more on how WSECU serves charities throughout our community, visit www.wsecu.org/community. And of course, visit our website to find out more about our incredible partnership with WSECU. And now, here's the show.
All right. I'll try to be less of a mess at this point.
Will you try?
I mean, I'll try. I cannot guarantee that. Okay. I mean, obviously, clearly a mess.
That's all I need. I just need you to try. That's it.
You really sound like an adult. Honey, I just need you to try.
Please use your big words. Okay?
Don't no matter what point, happens, I still love you.
I need you to try. Just don't disappoint me.
You got it. I'll use all my big words in this one.
Yeah. Yes. You better.
All right.
I'm counting syllables.
Greetings and salutations. Welcome to season three, a special episode. See, I'm using my big words, Ms. Lucas.
What, special?
Yeah, well, no, greetings and salutations.
Salutations is pretty good.
Yeah. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a very special episode of CFD's Podcast for Good. My name is Philip Kerrigan. I am the program manager of the Washington State Combined Fund Drive, and I am joined, as always, by...
Heather Lucas, the fiscal and policy coordinator for the Combined Fund Drive.
She is the fiscal and policy coordinator of the Combined Fund Drive.
Take that to the bank.
Yeah, take
literally.
Take it to the bank.
Cash that check.
Yeah. This is a special episode because we had some very special guests in the house.
Indeed.
And by house, we mean we recorded this particular podcast on location.
At a casino.
At a casino. We weren't gambling.
Truth.
Yeah, truth. We weren't gambling. It was the Little Creek, it was the Skookum Creek Event Center at the Little Creek Casino in Shelton. It was directly after our leadership breakfast. We had the incredible speaker from Medical Teams International, Rachel...
Chailiakoba,
and the senior philanthropy advisor?
Yeah, it's on your list if you want to read it off the paper.
Yeah, I should do that. David Carlson, both from Medical Teams International. David Carlson is just, I don't want to say just, he was a very, very awesome, he's a very, very awesome dynamic dude.
He is.
But he is your sort of regular charity employee.
Yeah.
Rachel was special because she hails all the way from Uganda.
Yeah, we've never had anybody come to an event just for us.
Yeah. That was the coolest.
Rachel came to not only the leadership breakfast just for us,
yes,
but filmed a little video
just
for us and then this podcast.
And then appeared on this podcast. Yes. Rachel's backstory is that she grew up in Uganda. One of 15 kids, she said?
She said 16, so, but now there's only 14.
Yeah. A huge family. Mm-hmm. Ended up getting into university in Uganda and became a healthcare professional.
Yeah.
And then reached out and started working for Medical Teams International in their refugee settlements. Mm-hmm. Specifically for her, she deals with refugees from South Sudan. Mm-hmm. Although it should be known that Uganda borders about two or three countries that are having major conflict, famine, disease,
political warfare,
and so they're dealing with tens of thousands of immigrants or refugees, not even immigrants, refugees per year. So she had this, she gave a very inspirational speech at the leadership breakfast about what she sees, the mothers who catch malaria and then they lose their babies. Just really incredible stuff. And then she sat down with us for basically almost like a half hour to 45 minutes to talk about her life in Uganda and what Medical Teams International does over there. So I thought it was really neat. We've never done this before. So excuse, maybe you might hear some rattling in the background.
Yeah.
I think it adds to the overall flavor of the
ambience.
Interview. It's an ambiance deal. We were on location, people.
Yeah.
at the leadership breakfast directly afterwards. So there's some good energy there. Her and David talk about some really neat stuff. Before we dive into that, though, we have, as always, mm-hmm. the question of the pod. So, Ms. Lucas, can you hit me with the question of the pod?
So this was a rabbit hole question.
Okay.
Okay. Because when I was thinking about, you know, what kind of question? Like
okay.
Medical Teams International, Medical mm-hmm. International. Mm-hmm. Okay. Philip Kerrigan, if you got the opportunity to study abroad,
yes.
where would you like to study?
Okay.
And what topic would you study?
So it definitely would be Africa.
Okay.
And I would very much like to study, just throwing this out there, mm-hmm. just throwing it out there. I'd very much like to study like sort of political science.
Okay.
Like you're in a country with a new government or a government mm-hmm. that's working. And so you try to like maybe see it in action.
Now you're talking like you're interested in this, so you would do it, or you're just like wildest dreams.
They were wildest dreams. Okay. I mean, I'm not doing that.
Sure, but I mean, would you be interested in studying political silence of African countries just like on the internet now?
Yes.
Okay.
I would definitely be interested in that. Okay. And I like to think that I can hold my own in a conversation about that sort of mm-hmm. stuff. It was pretty clear in our conversation with Rachel that I still don't know much about Uganda. But I think that learning about, like, it's the ultimate, like, blank canvas uh-huh. some African countries are, right? Like, they get rid of their authoritarian governments and attempt to replace them with more democratic governments. And point of fact, Africa as a continent is actually becoming, according to the Global Freedom Index, one of the more... like one of the countries that's having the most rapid amount of countries that are having freedom. So it's the continent where freedom is growing the most.
Yeah.
As they say it, right? Yeah. Like, so freedom of the press, you know, votes for all citizens, and then general like religious freedoms as well.
Yeah.
It is the continent that has the most countries that are growing into that. So it would be really interesting to see that sort of litmus test, you know, like
sure.
how are these countries doing? And are they doing anything that maybe we could do, mm-hmm. right? Like, because they're starting from scratch. So maybe they incorporate a few things that we don't.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know? So I think that'd be interesting. Nice. What about you?
I thought if I could study anything and go anywhere, I'd mm-hmm. probably end up in, like, Asiatic countries.
Okay.
Starting maybe, like, India, going okay. on the continent over to Ooh. Island nations.
Okay, okay.
And I was thinking about, you know, environmentalism.
Ooh, environmentalism.
These, like, especially with, like, island nations,
yes.
they are disappearing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At an extraordinary yeah, yeah, yeah. rate. So, you know, how do you, A, stop that?
Right.
Can you recover any yeah. of that land yeah. at any point?
That's cool.
Or, like,
I'm all right
just
with that.
Having to be like, hey, we're going to have to relocate everybody on in these places.
I'm all right with that. I would also go to Scotland, specifically St. Andrews, for golf studies.
Golf
or
studies.
Or Ireland.
I thought you were going to say Scotland for whiskey studies.
Ireland
yeah.
for the history of beer.
Nice.
Say one
nice.
Of those two. That'd be all right. Yeah. Or Germany.
Yeah,
you
Bavaria.
Can do that too, right? Bavaria's got some strong beer game.
Some serious beer game.
So I could do that too.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Nice. That's on the less serious. That'd be my safety school.
I applied for a state school in case I don't get into Harvard.
Right.
Nice.
Right. That's my safety school nice. Version of nice. Studying abroad.
I like it.
That's a great question.
Oh, thank you.
Well done.
Yeah.
I like that
Sometimes
one.
Sometimes these rabbit hole questions actually...
They go places.
Yeah. So ridiculous.
It is. Yeah, they're not always so ridiculous. Mustache. So anyway, without further ado, I want to toss it to this really incredibly compelling interview with Rachel and David. Here it is.
So we're here today with David Carlson, the Senior Philanthropy Advisor, and Rachel Chaliakova. She's an MTI nurse. They're both with Medical Teams International. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. You're welcome.
So Rachel, you set the record for longest trip to our podcast studio. Actually, we're not even in a studio. We're on location, baby.
On location, yeah.
On Leadership Breakfast. Can you tell people listening where you're from?
I'm from Uganda. Mm-hmm. Uganda is in East Africa, which is part of Africa as a continent, mm-hmm. and I work in Arua.
All right. That's mm-hmm. good. That's
and
good.
Arua is in the far northwest corner of the country of Uganda.
Okay.
Bordered by both South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm curious, though. Your flight, how many hours was that?
Around... 17 hours.
Okay. That's a little rough.
Yeah, with 2 hours of waiting in Amsterdam.
Uh-huh,
yes,
uh-huh.
So it was quite an experience.
Yeah, I bet.
First time
on a plane.
Yeah, first time out of Africa.
Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Well, for the CFD.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
CFD. We go the distance. Literally.
That's unbelievable. You know what I thought was funny? During the breakfast, as I was kind of walking the crowd to see how people were taking everything in, I saw people literally on their phones, like, typing in, where is Uganda?
Oh.
Like, they were looking up where it was at. Yeah. They were trying to get a context of, like, where you were talking about. So it was pretty cool.
Because
like,
it would have been helpful. We should have had a little slide with a map.
Yeah.
Like a little geography lesson.
Exactly.
It was awesome. It was awesome.
Yeah, people learned something new today.
Yeah,
so,
true.
So, mm-hmm. David, first question to you. Can you give us a little history of Medical Teams International and what is it that they do for the community?
So in 1979, 40 years ago this year, mm-hmm. a businessman from Salem, Oregon, was watching a news broadcast that evening about what was going on in Cambodia during Pol Pot regime mm-hmm. and what became known as the Killing Fields.
Yeah.
And all of the refugees that fled from there into Thailand. And while sitting there with his wife watching the news and watching his daughter was with him as well, they noticed a situation where young girls had been brutalized and whatnot that mm-hmm. had happened. And it just occurred to him that they had to do something.
Yeah.
Within 2 weeks, the decision was that they should rally a group of doctors and nurses, volunteers, even though that wasn't his background,
mm-hmm.
to go and serve in a World Vision field hospital.
Yeah.
And so 2 weeks later, with the help of TV and radio, he had 28 people volunteer to
Unbelievable.
And serve in that refugee hospital for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And that was the genesis of
what
became Medical Teams International.
Yeah.
Nice.
And we're celebrating 40 years this year. So mm-hmm. the focus now is primarily caring for people in crisis all over the world, particularly displaced people,
mm-hmm.
refugees, which is done now in Bangladesh, in Lebanon, who are the Syrian refugees coming out of there, the Rohingya refugees out of Myanmar into mm-hmm. Bangladesh, and in Rachel's case, where she's serving with refugee populations from the Congo, from Burundi, from South Sudan, as well as now we're doing refugee care work in Tanzania.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also do public health work in Guatemala, where we're strengthening mm-hmm. local health system services there. And then locally, as you saw today,
mm-hmm.
We provide free mobile dental care, as long as we can get lots of volunteer dentists and hygienists, we can do more through 11 mobile dental clinics throughout Washington and Oregon.
And there are these huge red vans that you can see just barreling down that way.
Two operatories in both of them, fully equipped. So any dentist listening, come sign up.
Come volunteer today.
Yeah. Awesome.
So why does Medical Teams International have a presence in Uganda right now?
I'll let Rachel answer that. Why do we have a presence in Uganda? Because we've been there since 2004.
Medical Teams has been in Uganda since 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And previously, they were helping with the internally displaced people mm-hmm. until 2008, when we moved into the refugee work.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the refugee work, why we are there, Uganda is a landlocked country
mm-hmm.
surrounded by all these countries that have different issues, political issues that are forcing their people to move every now and then.
Right.
So currently we have very many people of concern who you would call refugees coming in through all sorts of borders that we have around the country. And out of all those borders, Medical Teams International is serving in five locations, and majorly serving Congolese and South Sudanese coming in from South Sudan and then the DR Congo.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I might mention, because lots of people don't realize this, so here's a question for you.
Yeah.
What's the average length of stay in a refugee camp or refugee settlement?
Well, you just stole one of my leads, sir.
It should be short, but it's not.
Yes. My understanding is it is years, right?
17 years is the
unbelievable.
Average is 17.
Unbelievable.
So, and here's another thing. 80 to 85% of all displaced people around the world, of which there are currently 68.5 million, are women and children.
Wow. Yeah. That's unbelievable.
That is terrible.
17 years is basically a generation.
You know?
I mean, it's a whole generation that grows up in a refugee camp.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
And you just made a very important comment. In a refugee camp,
mm-hmm.
Uganda's different. They don't call them camps. because they recognize how long people will be in these situations. Mm-hmm. You're not going back tomorrow to a civil civil conflict. And so in Uganda, they call them settlements because they go on for years.
Okay.
And they actually give people land in Uganda because they know they're going to be there for a long
time. Wow.
Mm-hmm. So if they give people who are refugees land in Uganda a settlement, and part of the settlements, do they establish themselves and their families and their lives? Like, do they start trying to be normal again, essentially?
Yeah. The only challenge that we have is most of this big land that can be given to them is way from the existing towns, and it's more like in a wilderness, because that's where the government can get the big chunks of land to give out to thousands of people. But when they give them, like, when you go to areas like southwestern Uganda, where the land is better, the refugees, like the Congolese, are able to start up businesses.
I mean,
like farming, where they can do a little bit backyard gardening to supplement the food that's given to them by the partners that are working in the settlements. Mm-hmm. But when you come up where I'm working, the land is a little bit hostile, so they cannot really do so much for themselves.
Sure.
Yeah, they have to depend majorly on donations and food coming in from World Food Program and partners that are working in the settlements.
Yeah. I might mention that one of the things about Uganda, in addition to giving them land, so if you were fleeing the violence in South Sudan or Congo, like in the video this morning, Janet, and you came into Uganda, you'll have every right of a Ugandan citizen except one. You can't vote.
Oh, wow.
That's it. You can do. You can live there. You can work there. You have freedom to transfer from
That's pretty unbelievable. That doesn't usually happen.
No.
It's an open door policy, actually. Mm. When I started working in the refugee settlements, they used to have roadblocks that would limit the refugees on how much they had to leave the settlements.
Okay.
But currently, the government has gone into an open door policy where the settlements are open at any time, and then they can move and go and work even for the nationals at any time. So it's an open door policy.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
I bet that changes the face of the nation as well. Like people coming from so many different places.
Yeah.
And if they get to stay, and like in a settlement camp, I mean, it's 17 years average, so they're going to be part of the fabric of the community.
Well, if you contrast the two countries that I could mention, Lebanon, where currently 1/4 of the population of Lebanon are Syrian refugees.
Wow. Unbelievable.
And they're in camps. They don't get that kind of freedom in Lebanon. Yeah. Lebanon would rather that they're not there.
Sure. Yeah.
But they're there.
Yeah.
And so as compared to Uganda, where they're open-armed, welcome, come, we'll help take care of you with all these different partnering agencies. So different contrast.
Yeah, it definitely seems, it's way different.
And there's a million plus refugees in Uganda.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Rachel, can you talk a little bit about what life was like growing up in Uganda?
I grew up, personally, I grew up in a village, so I have had to work so hard to get where I am.
Yeah.
I grew up in a town that's far from the capital, from the capital city of the country. So I had to work so much, and I became the first, the best girl in my district in my year. So that helped me to get to the city schools. Uh-huh. And I was in one of the best schools in the city, which helped me to go to college or university, still in Kampala. And that gives me an opportunity to work for international organizations like medical teams where I'm currently working. Yeah.
Yeah. So. And how many siblings did you have?
I come from a very big family. Like I said, I grew up in sort of a village. So in Africa, it's very common for men to have very many children, and Uganda, where I come from. So I grew up in a family of 16 children, though currently we are 14. I lost two brothers. And out of the 14 currently, I'm number 10.
Oh.
So it's a big family, really.
Yeah, that pales in comparison to my one brother.
And my one brother.
Yeah.
I got two brothers, so I beat you both.
Yeah. Right.
So, Rachel, what made you want to start working for Medical Teams International? What led you to work for them?
10-year anniversary coming up.
Oh,
wow.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah.
So what made me to join medical teams. I would say I previously used to work for Plan International. It's a German-based organization.
Okay.
And they used to work for children. And I basically, you know, you can be in a country and not know exactly what's going on around your country.
Yeah.
But because of the short contracts, I was kind of motivated to look around for another job.
Yeah.
And when I looked through the newspapers, I saw this advert about an NGO that was working for refugees in the settlements. And I was kind of interested. I was like, mm-hmm. what's happening here? I can apply and see how it goes. And the moment I joined medical teams, it has kind of been hard for me to leave for the last 9 years. And I make 10 very soon.
Yeah.
You just get attached to the refugee work and it's just hard to live.
Yeah.
You just want to help them every day to see what you can do every day and to see that the majority are women, and personally being a woman and a mother, and some of them, of course, women come along with their children. That is what just keeps motivating me to keep going on.
Yeah, yes. Unbelievable. Can you walk us through, this question is for both of you guys, can you walk us through sort of what a typical day looks like in a refugee settlement in Uganda? So how many folks, first of all, how many folks roughly are in the settlement? And then is it a structured day? Is it more just like walking through a city? Can you talk a little bit about what a typical day looks like?
Maybe for me personally, I'll talk about how we receive the refugees. Mm-hmm. I think that would be an interesting point at this time. Refugees usually come in at the borders. Like I said, Uganda is a landlocked country, so they come out through the borders where we have buses and trucks that ferry them from these border points mm-hmm. to areas that we have created in settlements that are called reception centers.
Okay.
Where they are received, and within the reception center, it's kind of an enclosed area with mm-hmm. a gate and guards, of course, and all these partners are like medical teams for health, partners for protection, partners for water and sanitation, for food. We are all enclosed within there, ready to receive the refugees. So when they come in buses, the first people that they meet is the health partner.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as Medical Teams International, we screen them for different kinds of
okay.
Diseases of outbreak potential, for things like Ebola, cholera. We screen them for all those things, their nutrition status, and then we give them all the vaccinations that we immunize people against in Uganda, measles, tetanus, and polio. So they get that at the time they come into Uganda. That's the first thing they receive.
But and imagine this.
Yes.
2 years ago this time,
yeah.
10,000 a day.
I know. And that was kind of my thinking. Is yeah. It sounds like it's this orderly thing that we should actually probably do on our here, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, I imagine that you're talking about the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which has been unstable for years, mm-hmm. and then South Sudan, which, of course, everybody knows the circumstances involving South Sudan. You've got to be talking about major numbers here. Mm-hmm. That's a huge influx of people. Is it fast-paced, or is it more like we take our time, we make sure we're... How does that usually go?
No, you can't determine how many people will come through the borders.
So right.
You have to always be ready mm-hmm. for anything and any eventualities, and especially when the influx starts. So that means the UNHCR and our government in Uganda, they have to hire as many buses as possible.
Wow, yeah.
And trucks to ferry these people, because and of course sometimes the hiring depends on how many they are getting per day.
Mm-hmm.
That determines how many buses they'll have to hire. But once they know the numbers, then they'll have contracts with service providers that
yeah.
will keep bringing in buses and have these refugees, because sometimes the border points are far from the reception centers where they have to start
right.
from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. And Ebola is
huge issue right now in
yeah.
the Democratic Republic mm-hmm. of Congo.
So how to walk me through how that screening goes. You probably don't have a ton of volunteers who are volunteering to screen for Ebola.
Yeah. currently, because Uganda is bordering Congo, and especially in Arua where I'm working, and very many areas in southwestern Uganda, in midwestern Uganda, where medical teams is also working.
Mm-hmm.
UNHCR and the government has done, and Ministry of Health in Uganda, they have been able to train very many volunteers.
Okay.
We choose this from the communities, village health, that we call village health teams.
Okay.
And they have also trained our staff, some of our staff, ready to screen for Ebola.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we've trained barrier teams that in case of any case or any situation of Ebola, then they can always do the barrier. They can always handle the barriers. Then we have had to buy supplies. We have UNHCR has bought so many supplies to help in this in case the crisis spreads out to Uganda.
Yeah.
And at the border points, we have trained people.
Okay.
So that they are able to also screen at that point. And we have also sensitized them about the issues to look out for.
Sure.
And what exactly you can see and know this is Ebola, like the fever, the high fever, the bleeding through all open
areas
of the body.
Your
yes.
Eyes,
yeah.
Nose, your ears,
yeah, everywhere. So we have sensitized people on that. And also on, at the airstrips, we have trained a couple of people to be able to handle and screen
sure.
in case of any Ebola system.
Yeah.
And of course, there is a system in place where they can always call. The numbers have been shared for the surveillance teams from the districts to be able to respond immediately they see any suspect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Wow. Excellent.
Currently, 1,000 have died of Ebola in the Congo, so second largest outbreak since the one that we all heard about a few years ago.
Right, and that's one of these things where it's the sadness of the news cycle, because that last Ebola outbreak was something we heard all about here.
Mm-hmm.
And then this particular Ebola cycle, which seems to be verging on just as bad,
is
not something that people in this country are hearing very much about.
Yeah, we don't hear about hardly any of these
kinds
of things.
I know.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
And like along with the news cycle, I mean, we get this constant stream of refugees are not good for our country. Refugees shouldn't be welcome. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of myths about what, you know, who a refugee is, why they are a refugee. So, you know, in working with refugees, have you seen, of course, like people who leave, they don't want to leave their homes.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody does.
Yeah, nobody.
But I mean, is it kind of an overwhelming response? We want to go back home at some point?
Yeah, a majority of the people that come in, they I think everybody would love where they are coming from, your home.
Yeah.
East or west, home is best.
Like, yeah.
I'm looking forward to going back to Uganda.
Even for that 17-hour flight.
Yeah.
So it's the same with the refugees. Everyone always looks forward to going back to their countries. But unfortunately, because when they come in, even when we have the open door policies, even when we give them plots of land, it doesn't sum up to what they left back at home.
Right.
So you can never start in Uganda afresh and compare it to what you maybe possibly could have had back home. And majority of them come when they used to have very nice jobs way back home, and then you come to a settlement and you have to start from scratch.
Right.
So, of course, most of them are really interested in going back, but then the political situation in the country do not allow this, and that's why they have to stay within these refugee settlements, staying in a very small house, because what the partners do, especially UNHCR, is to just provide them with a tarpaulin and then a few poles, so they are able to just put like shelter over themselves.
Okay.
So I think everybody would want to really go back, and they really try, only that when they try to go back there, they still find the situation is not good, which bounces them back to Uganda.
Right.
Yeah. And do you find that for refugees that you interact with, is it easy for them to assimilate to the settlement, or is it difficult for them to say, okay, well, now I'm a Ugandan citizen and this is my life until what?
Otherwise noted.
Otherwise noted, yeah.
It's not easy because, I mean, you come sometimes without even picking your documents, because even if we have an open door policy and freedom for them to work, if you don't have the documents, if you don't have the licenses, then it becomes hard for you to get a job. So sometimes many of them, and especially the women and the children who leave their husbands back home fighting, they come to Uganda and it's just psychological torture for them, because you don't know whether your husband is still alive.
Wow.
Yeah. You don't know whether your children, maybe some of them, because some, we have had stories where some of them, the war comes up and maybe they are far from their other their family members, and they have to run with only those that are there. So it's it's some sort of mental disorganization that they have to go through, and it takes time for them to really settle in, and it takes organizations like medical teams to really counsel them mentally. Some of, we have seen very many of them running mad in the settlements because of what they have gone through.
Of course.
It's not easy to PTSD, really take it.
It's incredible stress.
And we have behavioral help with Medical Teams International.
Excellent. That's great. Awesome.
Increasingly, that's become an important understanding on our part of how do we treat not just the physical needs, but the psychosocial needs.
Right. We took a tour of your facility in Redmond.
Right.
And one of the neat things that I thought was really interesting was you are an emergency service in that you're on the ground, like right there, like triage basically. But then beyond that, you're also attempting to make it to where you build long-term sustainable efforts that don't involve maybe you, right? So can you talk a little bit, Rachel, about do you have hope for sort of conflict in the region, things getting better? Do you see Medical Teams International playing a big role in that as well?
Getting better at the other side or in the
Like, I mean, do you have hope that one day you won't get as many refugees? And do you see that ever changing, or do you think this is something that will take a long time?
I think in Africa it's kind of unpredictable. The leaders are unpredictable. They have had very many peace meetings, like agreement meeting, where they come and start initiate meetings for peace among themselves, like what is happening in South Sudan. But then when it comes on the day for signing, you just hear that it has failed to work out.
Oh wow!
So many people have tried to have to be like a go-between the two people that are fighting for power in South Sudan, but so far it hasn't yielded anything, and that's why we've been in these settlements for very many years. But not so long ago, we saw the Pope trying to bring them together. So we are hoping that with this Pope meeting them, it will yield some good results, because they are both very staunch Catholics.
Sure.
And having the Pope come all the way to meet them, we are still waiting.
That was
for
something. That was a heck of an image. Does Uganda get a seat at that table? Do they? Because Uganda is affected by those two conflicts. They continue to get refugees pouring over. Do they get to have sort of like a stake in it, where they get to sit down and talk with both governments and try and work it out too?
Yeah, we've tried, but that was among the things that failed to work out.
Sure,
In the past.
Yeah, it's tough stuff. Yeah.
The issue of repatriation is challenging. For example, a few years back in the Southwest, where you used to work, where a number of refugees came in from Rwanda. And Burundi, there were attempts for some to kind of force the repatriation to go back.
Right.
And it was a very difficult reality that they went back to.
Right.
Some ended up disappearing. So.
And jumping off the vehicles.
They would
rather die than going back. Because they believe they are not safe back where they are going. So that's why Uganda is using the voluntary repatriation, unless they come up and say, we are ready to go back.
Yeah.
Then we can't force them to go back.
Wow. Unreal.
I can imagine that would be a logistical nightmare to force people to go back to a home that
they don't know
exist.
What's there.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. You have no way of knowing.
Because the government was thinking like Rwanda and Burundi have kind of been stable for some time and people needed to go back, and they decided to just jump off, and at least maybe I would rather end my life than going back to an area that I've been out of for some long time and I don't know whether my life would still be safe.
Unbelievable.
So,
unbelievable. Wow.
So let's say someone hears this podcast and they want to start giving to Medical Teams International. Can you talk about what donations do for your organization?
Yeah, so thank you. That's an important thing to know, that every little bit helps, as we always hear that saying.
Yep.
But it's so true. And you were saying that this morning up there, and the ways that you showed what a dollar or $5 or $50 can do. When we look at the work and scope of the, particularly in the refugee context, with displaced peoples, it can be a small donation that's coming in on a regular basis is always very, very valuable because it goes to the overall program costs of what we do.
Right.
And when you're talking about whether that's purchasing of in-country, for example, in Uganda, we do not, we ship every year $30 million plus of medical, donated medical supplies and products
to
places all over the world.
Right.
But in some places, it's better for us to actually buy those supplies if they're available in country.
Yeah.
Why? Well, it's supporting the local economy.
Right.
Back to the sustainability issue.
Yeah.
Right? So Uganda happens to be one of those places.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees or USAID, other agencies may provide supplies as well, but we will actually buy products and supplies to deliver to these remote regions where the clinicians are doing the C-sections, doing the health care, and that those dollars that come in make a big difference. The other thing that's really critical, which is kind of cool, I was talking to Sherry Nelson about this, is that the leveraging of dollars that come from private givers, donors, whether it's through a state organization like CFD or personally out of their own pocket, when it comes in, it enables us to go to the institutional funders.
Mm-hmm.
So your European Union, your USAID, your United Nations.
Yeah.
They like to see that we have support from private donations, 15 to 20%.
Okay.
So it's like when you tell somebody, if you give a dollar, you're actually going to leverage, you know, huge amount of giving from institutional donors because it takes millions to do this kind of work.
Yeah.
The other thing that's critical, and a lot of people don't realize this, is that most of that institutional money that comes is on it. You have to reapply every year.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. And it's like, it's never like a one page document.
No, exactly. It's a huge deal.
That's
starting to change in the humanitarian space because there's recognition that that puts organizations in a very difficult place because of, you can imagine trying to ramp up her staff of 345 people that she manages. And now, you know, you have an influx coming in and you've got, and so, okay, you get funding for it that year, but, and now you've got the ongoing need, but you got to reapply again.
Yep.
Yeah, it's not guaranteed.
Yeah.
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 So there's that kind of giving that, you know, contributions from a small amount are leveraged that way to provide daily care.
That's awesome.
In each of these clinics.
Awesome.
Yeah. Very nice.
So, David, do you have any upcoming events or promotions you'd like to highlight? And I think I know you have one.
I do. We'd love to see some people there. So every year we have a thing called the Field of Dreams. Down at the Mariners baseball park, now known as T-Mobile.
Yeah.
Originally before known as
Still
Safeco.
Not used to that.
And, still probably call it Safeco.
Yeah.
And that's on June 8th.
Awesome.
And we love to have people come. It's a quite an event, as you can attest. You've
I got the chance to go there last year. Yeah. It was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't stop talking about
it. I know. Couldn't. It was great.
Well, thank you for doing so, Philip. Yeah. and there's the opportunity there to go through our exhibit, which we have a mobile version of the exhibit that you saw, the real life exhibit we call, which is a way to help people kind of immerse themselves for a moment in what is it to go into these kinds of settings that Rachel comes from examples all over the world, as well as locally with our mobile dental. And then participate in a dinner auction that we do there every year.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun and raises typically $1.5 million to
$2 million. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
I couldn't believe the amount of money that was being. I was like, I raised my paddle once because my wife and I had talked about, well, you know, we can get up to like $700 for this one.
Yeah.
And I raised my $700. Instantly, 10 people were like, 1,000. Okay, well, I'm out.
Yeah, he's out.
Yeah, it didn't go well for me at the live auction. But I got a few things to silent.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. So, it's really cool. Encourage people to take a look at that.
And the other thing we do, in fact, Rachel just spoke about this, which may be particularly of interest to women within the network of the state employees, is called Healthy Women, Healthy World. And that is once a quarter. It's an educational time.
Awesome.
Where people come. So Rachel was one of those that spoke this last Wednesday, or Tuesday, I guess it was, where we had people come and they share about particular topics that are going on in the area. Where how women who are made healthy, given the opportunity to have health, the impact that has.
Yeah.
And it's a way for women here to be involved in doing that.
Yeah.
So that's those are once a quarter.
It's excellent.
Great thing. Doesn't cost anything.
Yeah.
Come get educated. They have a luncheon once a year to raise money for some particular project mm-hmm. that's focused on women needs. Yep.
And you have a site in Redmond. I kind of mentioned it earlier. Mm-hmm. Is that something that people, if they give a call or float an email
yes.
to Medical Teams
yeah,
International, they can take a look at?
We have what we call the real life exhibit there, the standing version of it, much more expansive that you've seen mm-hmm. than what's shown down at the T-Mobile Park.
Yeah.
Our headquarters is actually down in Tigard, Oregon, so south of Portland. But our office is currently in the Mike and Kathy Holmgren
yeah.
building,
yeah.
named after a former Seahawk coach,
because
uh-huh. they have continued to be very big supporters. And like Jordan Babineau actually was our MC a few years
oh,
ago.
Oh, wow. Nice. So that's
yeah.
cool.
Yeah, so that was yeah. a fun connection.
Yeah, that's yeah. awesome.
Small world, right?
Yeah, right? Well, David, Rachel, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, this special one from the Leadership Breakfast
this
on location.
Awesome.
Yeah,
okay. How about that?
Yeah. So we appreciate you guys very much coming on.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So that was Rachel Chialikova and David Carlson, both of Medical Teams International. Did I get that name right?
It was interesting.
Oh, okay.
Chialikova.
Okay. I tried.
Say it with confidence.
Chialikova.
See?
Okay. See, that's good.
Yeah.
That's a good job.
Yeah. I find that if you say something that you don't know how to pronounce with mm-hmm. confidence,
mm-hmm.
even if you say it poorly mm-hmm. and someone corrects you, still sounds good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. Very cool to have Rachel there. I don't know if you caught it during the interview, but this was Rachel's very first time out of the country on a plane.
Yeah.
We did both of those two things, people.
Yeah.
Combined Fun Drive got her out of the country for the first time and on a plane for yeah. the first time.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. And I don't know if it was mentioned during the interview, but it was during the breakfast. Mm-hmm. She's 8 months pregnant right now.
Yeah.
So right. she's also traveling
right.
while being pregnant.
Right. Right. And her first pregnancy, she got malaria
three times.
She's gotten malaria twice on this one already.
Yeah.
I mean,
madness.
Holy moly.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a tough one.
She is.
And she was a super impressive interview.
Yeah.
You talk about like being proud of where you come from. She definitely she definitely comes out in a very 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 strong female voice for you know, little girls in Uganda who maybe want to try and become successful. It's
yeah.
pretty neat.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. But you probably have some facts and figures for me.
I do.
All right.
So we have done podcasts about refugees before.
We have.
So I thought about, you know, like maybe talk about some things that we didn't really talk about.
Okay.
Looking up some new stuff.
All right.
And I didn't know this, but DSHS has
yeah.
Economic Services Administration. We hear ESA
uh-huh.
all the time.
Yes, we do.
Whenever there's training.
Shout out to all those ESA volunteers.
Yeah, I work with the ESA.
Yeah.
I work for ESA.
Yeah.
I have no idea what ESA is.
I don't know what
is.
That means. Yeah.
It's DSHS, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So Economic Services Administration, they have an Office of Refugee and Immigrant Assistance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Didn't know.
Cool.
But they have new pilot refugee youth mentoring program, and then they've expanded the services for older refugees programs. So
okay.
they have these programs that are available.
Yeah.
DOH also has refugee programs. We talked a little bit about it during that last
yeah.
refugee podcast, but there are resettlement agencies in our state.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are charities.
Okay, yeah, of course, obviously.
Of course they
yeah,
are.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are a lot of them who are religious based. So
okay.
there's like the Diocese of Olympia, Lutheran
mm-hmm.
Community Services, Jewish Family Service, and then places like World Relief and International Rescue
mm-hmm.
Committee, who we did that one podcast with.
Yeah, that's right.
But I do have some trivia for you.
Oh, I love trivia.
I know. So, Washington State.
Yes.
It is, we have a diverse refugee community, but we are one of the top 10
okay.
states for refugee arrivals in 2017. 3,040 people.
Got it.
Came to Washington State from places all around the world.
Yes.
So Washington State, it's up there, right?
Yes.
So I would like you
yes.
to guess
yes.
some of these top 10 states.
Oh, I thought you were going in a totally different direction. Okay.
Where'd you think I was going?
I thought you were going to ask me what nationality are most of our refugees.
Well, you can answer that because
okay.
I'm sure you might know it
I know
from
a
last
few.
Time.
I know a few from the International Rescue
mm-hmm.
Committee.
Yeah.
Okay. It's the other top 10 states.
Top 10 states.
For refugees.
Yes, who have settled in the United States.
Okay, well, low-hanging fruit, there's got to be like a New York in there.
New York is number 5.
Okay, and then...
And I can tell you where people are coming from.
Okay, where are they coming from?
For New York, it's Myanmar,
oh.
number 1.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And Congo. Specifically ethnic groups, the Banya, Mulenge, Hutu, and Tutsi.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So those two places are number
California?
One. California? California is number one.
Okay.
I thought this was interesting. Uh-huh. Number one for California, yeah. Iran.
Oh, wow. That is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And they also get a lot of Ukrainian refugees.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
No,
I really would have thought more of like an Asian country because of the coastal connections.
Yeah. And then I don't know if they consider like what they consider anybody who comes in, say, a caravan from either central,
from
south,
south
or
down south. Yeah. I don't know how they exactly do that. I feel like you have to basically, you do have to like claim asylum of some kind.
And maybe the people who come in caravans or who are just coming across the border are not considered refugees.
So not yet.
I mean, come on. Like, not they're yet. Fleeing a
they
circumstance.
Ought to be.
So.
Okay. Another border state I feel like has got to be Texas. Are
Texas
they in there?
Texas is number two.
Okay.
So more than half the refugees that go to Texas come from Congo, Myanmar, and Iraq.
Wow. They got lots of folks from Iraq down there.
Yeah.
Huh? Okay. Let's see. I'm going to. let me feel like I'm just going to throw a state out there. How about North Carolina?
Wow.
Is it in there?
Yeah, number eight.
Bam!
Nice job.
Oh my gosh, I'm so good at trivia.
Most refugees who come to North Carolina are also from the Congo.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Lots of folks from the Congo.
Yeah. Which is some, like, that's a population that Rachel talks about.
Yep, that's right. Because they have a lot of that going on there.
Mm, they're close by.
Yeah. Shoot. And then maybe one more. Let's just go with, like, New Jersey?
No, not on the list.
Okay.
So number 10, Georgia.
Okay.
Number 9.
I was going to say that, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
I was going to say Georgia, yeah.
Too late.
Yeah. I know. I don't get the points.
So number 10 is Georgia. Number 9 is Illinois. In both of those states, the people are coming from Myanmar.
Okay.
Okay. You said North Carolina, number 8. Number 7 is Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah. That makes sense. They have a real tension between folks who are Muslim refugees there. And
yeah. Because there are a lot of people who are coming from Iraq and Syria, and of all the states in the country, most Syrian refugees are landing and staying in Michigan.
Yeah, yeah.
Pennsylvania is number 6, with Bhutan and Congo.
Bhutan?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Number 5, New York. Number 4 is Washington.
Wow.
And did you want to guess the largest population?
Yeah, I want to say it's Somalian and it's Ukrainian.
Ukraine is number 1.
Okay, yeah.
Fun fact, Ukraine and Iraq are the two countries that have sent us more than 100 refugees.
Wow.
No other country has met that 100 level, as according to...
100?
Yeah, 100.
Wow.
Yeah. Number 3 is Ohio.
Yeah, for whatever reason, I do feel like that was one of those that it was high on the radar. Yeah.
And their refugees are coming from Bhutan.
Okay. Wow, so lots of Bhutan.
Mm-hmm. So Texas, number 2, and number 1 is California.
Okay.
But then there's this other thing that's happening where people are settling in places like... Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, New York, where cities actually have been on the decline population-wise.
Yes.
You know, but whether that's because people are leaving for jobs or whatnot, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A lot of the places that are just dying as far as population, they're seeing a lot of economic depression.
Right.
But refugees are boosting their population numbers and kind of like revitalizing cities.
Yeah, it's the economic argument for refugees and immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Syracuse, New York, El Cajon, California, Decatur, Georgia, Clarkston, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Like these are places that have experienced like, you know, 20%, 40%, 60% population growth.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy. Now, you know, it really brings up the really interesting point because like I know that, you know, there's lots of back and forth about immigration and refugees. Yeah. But the reality is that like economically speaking, we are not having as many kids as we have had in the past in this country. And neither are other, you know, quote unquote, Western countries or even China. China is not having as many kids. So you're not going to have the same. They're actually some of them are at negative growth rates.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
The way you make up for that, like economic, like a base that you're going to be missing is by having folks who come in who are ready to work in those jobs.
Yeah.
And where other countries like in Europe and China are specifically going to struggle with those areas, the United States, because we still accept people overall, regardless of, you know, like sort of the rhetoric that we always get back and forth, because we actually are a country who accept refugees and immigrants, We are actually going in 20 years. That's going to help us economically still stay viable.
Absolutely.
Because we will have people who will still be willing to work those jobs. So, I mean, I think that's the economic case for making sure that we continue to take refugees and immigrants, aside from the whole humanitarian case. If you heard this interview with Rachel and you don't think refugees should be allowed in, then you don't. You are a robot.
Yeah. Which leads me to the last thing I have.
Okay.
Because, you know, the rhetoric is, it's terrible.
Pretty tough.
It is tough.
Pretty tough right now.
And sometimes you'll encounter somebody where they're just like anti-refugee and you don't quite understand why.
Yeah.
But to me, it seems like people don't put themselves in someone else's shoes.
They do
not.
I mean, I think that's happening overall for all
everything is terrible and everybody's unhappy.
Right.
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 So there's this woman called Worsen Shire and she is Somali.
Okay.
Her parents are from Somalia. And they had to leave.
Yeah.
So she lives in London now, but she's a poet. And she wrote this poem called Home.
Yeah.
And she wrote a piece called Conversations About Home at a Deportation Center in 2009 because it was inspired by a visit she made to an abandoned Somali embassy in Rome.
Okay.
Some young refugees, Somalian refugees, had turned that place into their home.
Oh, wow.
And in an interview, she told a reporter that the night before she visited, a young Somali had jumped to his death off the roof.
Oh, wow.
So that encounter opened her eyes to, like, how you live as an undocumented refugee in a place like Europe. So, like, something that always strikes me, and I'll put this poem up so people can read it. But something that always strikes me about, like, this poem and just how people don't put themselves in their shoes is, like, the first lines of this poem are, no one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark.
Oh, wow. That's good.
Okay.
I like that.
Yeah. I mean,
that's
you don't go somewhere else unless you have to.
Yeah.
Another one is you have to understand that no one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land.
Wow. I like that a lot.
That one always has stuck out to me because it's
true. Wow. That's really good.
There were all
these
people
for
a couple years, not so much recently. There's been more like landlocked countries that are experiencing problems and having refugees. But like when people were crossing the Mediterranean, when people leave Cuba.
People were dying crossing the Mediterranean.
People were dying crossing the water. And if the water is safer than the land,
that's an issue. Yeah, and I get it. Like, look, the thing about it is tough if you have a country, especially a country like some of the countries in Europe, where you're fairly landlocked, you're pretty small, you're at a pretty high population to begin with. Your government is could be in some cases already struggling to take care of the people that are already in country.
Yeah.
I get the idea of like, whoa, we now are going to suddenly accept like thousands and thousands of people who don't speak the language and don't have the same
when
customs.
We're not taking care of our own first.
Right. And may not be able to get a job for a few years because they're not assimilated in any way. I understand all that hesitancy, but I also think that we do have to look at it from their perspective.
Yeah.
These folks, and Rachel hit on it too, and David hit on it as well. These folks don't want to leave.
Yeah.
They want to stay home.
Yeah.
They can't stay home anymore.
Yeah.
So it is our job, for those of us who live in countries that can actually support it, and the only real hurt that comes from us is in our tax dollars or whatever. It's our job to help them out.
Yeah.
And we should help them so that eventually we can try to get them back to the country that they came from because they want to go too.
They want
to
go home.
But the average stay, as you heard, is 15, 16 years. Yeah. What are we supposed to do? We can't not take people.
Yeah.
That's just not what it's all about.
You're going to live in a settlement in the desert.
Yeah.
Resources.
And like, how can you really wake up in a society and say, well, yeah, there are all these people who are dying in the ocean or they're starving or they, you know, they're dying from war because they're afraid to leave and claim asylum. But you know what? We're cool because I got the coffee this morning.
Yeah.
Like, you have to have both. Like, you can't live in a world where you get everything that you like that you want and then like somebody
and
else
nothing
is.
You don't
yeah,
want. Yeah,
exactly. So I'm sorry. Like, sometimes I think that that's a pretty heartless argument.
Yeah. And also, I think that it's really naive for anybody in the United States to just assume that we're safe, we're never going to be refugees.
Yeah.
I think that's a naive attitude.
Right. It definitely is. And I mean
because environmental impacts can force us to leave our homes.
You could get nomadic
political
pretty fast.
impacts. Yeah, war could come here.
And again,
you know.
And we're also making the distinction between immigrants and refugees.
Yes.
Right? An immigrant could be coming solely for economic purposes. Mm-hmm. That's a different debate. That's like, well, should they really come or should they actually take a job in their home country, whatever. That's a different debate.
But a refugee has been forced to leave their home.
Yeah.
Either because of persecution or safety.
Yeah.
Like their lives are in danger.
Right. And so we're talking about people where there's a tangible base issue there. And so I think, unfortunately, we have this conversation.
We have it
completely wrong. Yeah. It's terrible.
It is terrible.
But it was really nice to maybe be able to lend a little bit of a human face to this particular conversation. I believe, like you believe, basically what you said there, the more you get to know somebody with that base, you know, the less and less likely you're going to be close-hearted about it. You know, the more and more you're actually going to care about, you know, what happens to folks because you know individuals now. You hear their stories. Yeah. So that's what I really loved about listening to Rachel. And David, just as a person who clearly has been doing it for a long time, knows a lot. And so it was really neat to talk to them about it.
Yeah, and it's really good to be like, this is a connection.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be siloed off.
Yeah.
And, you know, full of hatred or full of nothingness.
Yes.
Like, we all are connected.
Yeah, it was really cool. Yeah. That was really cool. And I hope that people who came to the breakfast got that. You know, kind of we're talking about upcoming events. The breakfast just happened. We're working with TVW right now to get that feed sent to us. So people who couldn't make it, you're going to have an opportunity to see her speech.
Yeah.
It's a fabulous speech. She does a great job. The video is fantastic that they brought out. So that just happened. Great event. We had 400 to 425 folks there. Great speakers. Thank you to Jordan Babineau and Alex Stone, too, for coming out and speaking. That was pretty neat. We are just next week. We're going to be doing campaign leader training. We're already into it, people.
That's crazy.
Oh, no. Actually, 2 weeks from now. Yeah. Sorry. May 30th.
May 30th.
I didn't mean to give you a heart attack.
No, you kind of did for a second. I was like, I'm not prepared.
So in 2 weeks, we're going to be having it. We'll have campaign leader trainings on May 30th, June 5th, and June 11th on various dates. Take a look at the site, and you can reserve your spot in one of those trainings. Also in July, we're going to have our 35th birthday, the CFD Film and Trivia Festival.
Yeah.
And so we'll have more announcements on date, time, venue, all that sort of different stuff and format. I think everybody's going to love it. We're going to show our top five best videos as voted on by the people. So we're going to give it to volunteers to vote on, and then we will show the five best. So overall, I just want to thank Rachel and David for coming and speaking to us. I want to thank Little Creek for hosting the Leadership Breakfast. It was fantastic. Thank you to TVW for filming it and also appearing on the podcast that will be upcoming, correct?
Yeah.
On Civility in the Media, another amazing conversation, by the way. So we want to thank them and thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.